Welcome one, welcome all, step right up, ladies and gentlemen, Portal Gaming Podcast, episode number 105, coming at you right now. Howdy everybody, Portal Gaming Podcast is a proud member of the Dice Tower Network. It is a podcast brought to you by a store called The Portal, which is located in Manchester, Connecticut. For more information, you can log on to www.timemachineportal.com. Check us out on Facebook, The Portal, and on Twitter, at PortalGaming60. And if you check out our Twitter account, that is me. I am your host for this episode, The Brant. And with me, for the first time on the Portal Gaming Podcast, is...
Mason.
All right, and Mason is here. Mason is a local patron and player all around the state, and sometimes at the Portal as well. So, Mason, introduce yourself, tell us about you, what you like to play, all those things that people want to know.
Hi, my name is Mason. I play a lot at the Portal, especially ever since moving back to Manchester. I enjoy playing largely area control games. Trick-taking games are a big favorite of mine, or they don't table as often. And I really like heavy Euros as well. So I often will hop in games with Brant anytime I get the chance, because that seems to be his forte as well.
Yeah, you know what it is with heavy... So I really feel like I'm an Omni gamer. I definitely stray towards the Euro side. More often than not, I'm going to like a Euro versus a Meritrash or whatever, in terms of that, or a high luck game, you know? But I really find that I like teaching, and most people want you to teach them heavy games. And so I fall perfectly into that category because people are ready to be taught those as opposed to learn them themselves. So that's kind of my spot.
Yeah.
Nice. How long have you been gaming?
I've been board gaming for about 3 years, but gaming since third, fourth grade. My DNA for as a gamer is largely made up of Magic the Gathering. Leading into in high school, I played a lot of abstract strategy games, largely chess, but basically anything with absolutely no hidden information and no randomness were a genre I really like to support or explore. I was kind of pretentious as a high schooler, as a gamer, so... And then in college I went back to Magic and then finally found board gaming whenever I got a job, and my competitive nature died down considerably whenever I wasn't able to put in the time to remain good at games. So
I feel like board gaming itself feels pretentious by nature, even though we know as hobbyists it's not. But it always feels like I'm telling people like I don't watch TV, and I don't play as many video games and things. I know you're laughing because I have my Nintendo Switch. It's brand new now. But, you know, it feels like you're trying to convince people to do some archaic hobby all the time. Like, you have some different thing. But it's not. It's the modern age of board gaming is better than the classic age of board gaming, which is interesting, you know?
Yeah, I mean, calling something better, though, is probably pretentious, but...
Touché.
But I fully agree. Like, that makes a lot of sense and something I hadn't really considered, that, like, trying to find yourself in a hobby that is gaining steam but not mainstream definitely will have you look pretentious, like getting into designer coffees or like craft whiskeys. You're going to look like, I'm not Maker's Mark. What's that? Like, you're always going to seem a little pretentious in something I never really considered.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's like I'll tell people, they're like, oh, do you want coffee? And I'm like, oh, I don't actually drink coffee. And they're like, good for you. I should really change my ways. And it's like, meanwhile, I'm downing like 3 Mountain Dews on the side and not mentioning it, you know? Like, just let them think well of me. So, nice. Before we move on here and tell you about games we've been playing lately, I just want to make sure to continue to announce on November 3rd the 24-hour marathon Extra Life charity event. Harrison and Gary are again running this, a major piece on their part, but this will be at the Portal all 24 hours. You do not need to come all 24 hours. There'll be multiple events and fundraisers and things going on. So come out, play games, donate, support the cause. The money goes to the Connecticut Children's Medical Center right in Hartford. which is a great local thing to support. I know my daughter has had to go there before and have things done, so, you know, definitely something that is near and dear to my heart. So, yeah, definitely make sure you check that out. Like I said, you don't have to be there all 24 hours, but if you've got 24 hours free, then come on out.
Yep, and I also heard Harrison just announced that they have these awesome-looking magnets that he drew based off of Root characters that will be available to anyone who makes a $5 donation. So, yeah, they look great. He's been drawing a lot of Root characters. He's a huge fan of Kyle Farron's art and has been taking to drawing things in that style. So I highly recommend checking that out and dropping a fiver on some of those magnets.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, there should be lots of good stuff, so... Check that out. All right, Mason, tell us what you've been playing lately.
Well, let's start off with John Company, since that's one I actually got to play with you. Mm-hmm. That is a terrific simulation kind of game based off of the Dutch East India Company, which is a part of history you may not have heard of, but just think of England's version of the 2008 financial crisis, but with a significant amount more chicanery than you might expect would ever be allowed without revolt. It was a pretty wild time, and the game kind of captures that essence perfectly. We did a lot of things where we would just let our company fail because that would make us more money or set us up to do better. I ended the game with, I think, like 100 in-game dollars, so probably in the realm of millions, versus everyone else who only ended up with like $5 or $6, but that didn't win me the game because at that time money didn't always mean the most power because it was just a number. So it really captured that well, and had a good time playing. It's also by Cole Worley, which you probably know him from Root by now, but he continues to show that he's a pretty tremendous designer on making these interesting heavy games.
Yeah, he's interesting because he has like a degree in some kind of history studies, you know, historical. And so the Cole Worley I think of is the infamous Traffic, Pax Pamir, John Company Cole Worley, and then Root, you know, came out and he made that kind of mainstream game, which is great. Mm-hmm. I mean, Root's a great game too. And showing off his ability to kind of flex around there. And John Company is published by Sierra Madre Games. We should mention that as well. So I think that simulation piece is what feels so important to me. Like, it's much less of a Euro, even though you're scoring points in the end and you're gaining resources, and it's more of that, like, what's going to happen and how are you going to react to it. There's a lot of randomness. There's mitigatable randomness, but there's also still a lot of randomness, and things are happening, and it's kind of like, how are you reacting, and how are you interacting with the other players is the key element of the game.
Yeah.
In terms of all that, what would you say?
Yeah, no, I would agree. I do find it always interesting every time I get into war games, a game like that, simulations, you find a lot more randomness, and I kind of like that because it basically models the idea that there are just a lot of events that you're going to be having just happen to you.
Yeah.
That you really can't do anything about. I mean, you can mitigate it, as you said, but these are just things that happen, and a part of these games, when you're going into it, you are going to need to let the game take you a little bit for a ride.
Yeah.
And I did like that part too. You did mention this was a Sierra Madre game, you mentioned before before we started recording, their rule books were a little rough. I think we should mention that this one's no different. There were some rules that we did miss the first time around, made it a little bit of a different experience. I will be trying this game again on Monday. I'm hoping to have a smoother ride, but even with the rolls being missed, it was still quite a ride of a game.
Yeah. I will even take the blame there. It's my second time playing John Company, and missed rules the first time, now got them, and missed other rules the second time. I feel pretty confident going to my third game, so I don't think the arc is much bigger than that in terms of learning the rules. And I do think, from the many Sierra Madre rule books I have read, this is the best one, but they just make these very quirky games that are hard to make solid rule books for. But this one is readable, as opposed to Bios Megafauna, that's like learning biology from reading the rule book.
Yeah.
It's a little tough on that front. Although I think I did well with the Bios Megafauna rules in comparison. But yeah. So but it was a good game, and if you like high levels of interaction and yeah. And all that kind of chaos that comes to it, and that idea of who's going to tank the company and who's going to try to get money in their coffers and who's going to try to pull all sorts of shenanigans, and this game is there. It's not really take that. It's just...
Oh, no.
It's just... yeah, it's working the system outside the game. The game gives you constraints, and then you work around it there, right?
Yeah.
And kind of that piece.
Yeah, there are two games I would say that I guess it felt somewhat similar to, because there was a lot of like promoting people and choosing who gets promoted, and that's Kremlin and Nothing Personal by Tom Vassell, actually, the second one.
Yeah.
Those are both games where the people at the top get to choose who fills their spot, and I kind of got like a little bit of vibes of
yeah.
that. So if you do like those games but really want to take like, and I mean a massive step up, this might be one to look into.
Cool. Nice. What's next up on the list?
So I just wanted to talk about Rising Sun, since I have started thinking more and more as the year's winding down of what might be my game of the year, and this is definitely starting to solidify here. I've gotten to play it twice in the past, like, 2 or 3 weeks, and it still continues to be an absolute blast. It's a game by Eric Lang, published by CMON, or Cool Mini or Not, as they used to be known, and it is a kind of an area control game where you are trying to control various areas of Japan, win battles there in the second phase of the game, and grab points that way. It also has that little bit of a Blood Rage aspect where you're going to get points if you lose battles in the right way. So that's going on too, but just an absolute tactical blast, and a game I like a lot. Yeah, Rising Sun, probably going to end up being my game of the year.
Nice. Yeah, I've only played it once, but I can tell you that area control is not my thing. Many people that listen to the podcast know that I struggle greatly. So the granddaddy El Grande, I literally think I had a hissy fit in the middle of the game. the last time I played it about 2.5-3 years ago. I remember playing it prior and enjoying it, so it might have just been my misunderstanding sometime of area control. But there were so many powers and so many things going on and being passed around in Rising Sun. It feels like a game that, yes, after I know those 5 times and I can read what people would do best, but we were all playing it for the first time. I mean, this was like day 2 after it had backed on Kickstarter. So I would be willing to play the game again. But I would fear that area controlness would kick in. There are games where I like the area control, and it's always kind of like finding the area control I like and the area control I don't like, because I haven't been able to discover exactly what it is that I don't like, mm-hmm. you know? But it's that being ahead by one and knowing, like, should I add 2 more cubes to this? Or should I focus somewhere else? And then I decide to focus somewhere else, and somebody immediately turns around like, aha, that was perfect, you set me up to take that over from you and remove all of your cubes. And like, no, why didn't I see it? And that's so frustrating at times. But there's that. But clearly that is a beautiful production of a game. Rising Sun is amazing, you know, in terms of all that.
Oh, yeah. Mind if I take a guess on, I think I have a guess on why you might not like some area control games. I'm wondering if it's because of something that I do have a big problem with area control games, but I look past it because I love them so much. I think it's the idea that that if like all 3 other people at the table just looked at you and decided you're not winning, they can do that.
Yeah.
And that's something that you just can't do in Lisboa, Agricola, Caverna, Great Western Trail. Like, if I wanted Ted or someone to just not win Great Western Trail,
right.
I can't stop him.
Yeah.
If he just outplays me, he outplays me. Do you think I...
I think that can be an element. I guess, and maybe I have the kill the leader mentality. So it's like, if that person's winning, we need to not continue to allow them to win. And other people will say, well, I'll let other people worry about that, and I'll focus here. And I get frustrated that people are not cooperating against that person. Now, there's some games where somebody's just a perceived leader, right? Or or they have the most victory points on the board, they're that leader, but they don't have any, you know, potential on the board. So I can understand in those where people don't do that. But where it's just clear-cut, small world is like the classic example to me. If you know that person has the most money or points, and they have the most units on the board, like, we need to attack them. And so I cannot play small world without the points face up. It drives me insane.
Oh, interesting.
Because I've just played so many games where people just, they'll just assume I'm lying to them when I say, well, that person has the most money. So, and when you're only getting, you know, 8 to 12 coins a turn, it's like everybody could just do the math anyway. So I just prefer the coins face up in that game. And then everybody knows who's leading. And then if you decide you want to attack the person in last place, you've made an informed decision. And I'm okay with that.
Interesting. Yeah. So, that's one of the handful of games that, like, I like to put that kind of fake shawl on of that, like, hidden victory points, even though they could be counterable.
Yeah.
Just because for me, it's like, I want it to be like such a snappy game, and I worry that whenever you do that, you start to have one person who's like, okay, we're gonna math this out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I
play with a table of those people. We're all mathing this out and trying to figure out.
Some people love that. I sometimes like to just trick myself into the surprise, but then there are games where I'm absolutely like, okay, no, we have to play everything face up because the game is about the math. So yeah. I don't know exactly whatever causes that line to cross, but I do always find that interesting for people who, because I mean, as I said, there are games that I do like to do the same thing. So that'd cool. be something I'd love to explore more.
The next one on your list is one of my favorite games from last year.
Yep, Spirit Island. In fact, Brant was the one who taught it to me at VannerCon last week, right?
Mm-hmm.
Spirit Island is a nice, big, meaty co-op. It definitely is in the Pandemic family, where it's just a map that you're trying to control, and you take on the role of a spirit, and everyone at the table has their own spirit that they're taking control of. You have these cards that you're playing to do your actions. It's hugely complicated with a lot of different moving pieces to worry about, but it makes that just ever more satisfying of a puzzle. I really liked this one a lot. The only thing that was a little off for me was we ended up playing with some elements of the expansion, specifically the event deck, which I actually think is a really interesting part, and I will plan after probably my fourth or fifth play, if I do end up buying this, which I think I will, adding that in. But for the first play, it just made it hard because there'd be a lot of things that we would flip over and be like, all right, how does the rules work? And like, Brant's in the other room, we'd call over to him, hey, how does this work? We'd even bring him the card. It ended up slowing down the game a little bit, but I still absolutely loved this game. It was just a really, really cool system to explore.
Yeah, the game's great. I think I reviewed recently, having played Branch and Claw, which was adding all those. You played with everything. The only thing you didn't play with were the scenarios and the adversaries, which are basically just there to up the difficulty. What's tricky with the scenarios and adversaries is they can make the game more fiddly, because there's more things you have to worry about. Oh, in this round do this, and in this round do that. Although, I have played with some of them, and discover they're not as fiddly as they sound like they're going to be. Like, it's pretty straightforward in terms of all that. But I can see that, like, the first time playing with the events, you know, could be something to just leave out with the rules overhead. Maybe with somebody who knows all those, then they're just like, oh, we do this, and then we do this, and then we do this, and we move on in terms of all that. But, yeah, the game's so good. What did you think about with 4? Like, I know it was your first play. Did you feel like 4 was too many?
So I'm a bit weird whenever it comes to player counts. I'm pretty famous at game meetups. Anytime that a game is going to be turning into a 5-player game, you'll see me immediately bow out of the game, because I've played so many games at 5 and have liked less than 10% of them at that count. Co-ops are even more aggressive for me. I pretty much just love co-ops at 2, mm-hmm. Because that's kind of my backdoor into getting rid of the alpha player problem.
Sure.
If you're playing at 2 and you're alpha gaming someone, you're just like, that is just a level of being a jerk that most people can't ever get to. To like look at one person and be like, no, you're doing this. Right. Like at that point, no, just play it solo then. Right, right. But yeah, I But it was still pretty enjoyable, especially for my first time. I kind of just looked at it as a demo game. But yeah, I would, whenever I get this, this is almost always going to be a two-player game for me, just because, that's kind of how co-op games go. Otherwise I usually end up rearing my ugly head as the alpha player.
Yeah. This game's tough to alpha though, with all the cards and all the things you're reading. Now what you can do is be like, wait, this region is not, we haven't figured out what to do here, and somebody figure out what to do here. You could do those kind of things, but to actually know what everybody's holding is a lot in a game like this.
You know, you're actually right. I didn't really think about it that way, and that actually, and you did tell me before the game, and I didn't really ignore it. It just was a lot going on, and I didn't really contextualize it. But the game did solve the alpha problem that way. You just could not keep everything. You could not keep everything straight, and it really just created teamwork through that, where yeah. People are like, I'll do this. It was a committee, and that was really cool. The big problem that still ended up happening is the game really did slow down quite a bit. And I think our play, I didn't actually entirely keep track, but I think it was like three and a half hours.
Whoa.
Which is kind of nutty, but it was a good 3.5 hours, but yeah, I don't really want to, like, I loved that game. I don't know if I would want to play it at 3.5 hours a clip again.
Yeah. I think I played it the morning. VonnerCon's tricky to remember which day I played everything, but I either played it that morning that I taught you or the morning before at 2, and we like snapped through it in 55 minutes or something. You know what I mean? With 2, it was just much, much less time because there's just not as much going on. Also, how do you feel about the difficulty of the game, or is that just a hard thing to register? Like the actual hard to win, how did you feel about that on a first play?
Oh, way too easy for the first play.
Yeah,
okay. And
that's the biggest fault of the game.
I'm really,
it's too easy.
Which is, you know what? It is kind of nice. Like I feel like my rule of thumb is for co-ops, I would prefer to always win my first play of them always. Provided that I can up the difficulty layer later. I always, like, whenever I'm teaching co-ops, when I'm setting the difficulty for people, I always want them to have like a good 70-80% chance to win. I think that that's the best experience. And then once you truly fall in love with the systems of the game, absolutely add that 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th epidemic card and go crazy.
Right.
But
and where Spirit Island does that well is it basically starts you at the peak or right prior to the peak. Like the island is pretty full, and then here comes a bunch of stuff, and it gets a little bit fuller, and then you start to get it under control. So it's not like where it starts low, and if you do well, it never, like, nothing really ever gets on the island. Mm-hmm. It actually starts, like, at close to critical point, and then comes down. So it at least makes players feel like, oh, it was at a hard point, and we figured that out. We broke that, you know, that element of what was happening. I don't know if your game was different.
No, our game was exactly like that. The only problem is that the game didn't end after we had won. We had to play one more turn. And that's a little rough.
Oh, yeah.
The
ending is super anticlimactic.
Yeah, that's a little rough. I kind of wish that they had fiddled with that a little bit more. They do this weird thing, not really weird, interesting thing, where every time you get more fear, your win condition gets a little easier. I think that they should have definitely worked on tweaking that a little better to make sure that the game kind of ended whenever you had, like, making sure that the win condition got easier as you were also cleaning up the island at a rate where those two just matched and the game ended at the right moment. That is why Pandemic is always going to remain my favorite co-op, because it just, the endings are always the tightest thing.
Yeah.
But this will absolutely make it into my family at some point, because it's an absolutely worthy one to be sharing with people, and especially the people in my life who I also know love Pandemic. I think they'd get a real kick out of this one too.
Yeah. It's Greater Than Games is the publisher on that. We should mention that.
Oh yeah, and I don't actually know the designer.
I want to say it's Eric Roos, I believe is the designer.
That might be right. It was Riddle was was it a co-design though, or was it just to
say? Nope, I think it's just him.
Okay.
So there's that. Final game.
All right. Final game I wanted to talk about is Fog of Love. I haven't actually played this one recently, but it's because it's a strange one to get to the table. It's a nice two-player, mostly co-op, where you're navigating a relationship. And In it, you are playing these, you are basically, almost just playing a game of, like, the Newlyweds game, where someone plays a card, and the other person has to guess what you want, and you're trying to basically see if you're simpatico in that, and it's just a big game of that, and then by the end of it, you, you see your relationship levels, everything about, everything that went on with that, and you hope that you, achieved one of the win conditions in your hand, and sometimes you can be happy in a relationship and the other person isn't. Sometimes you can both be unhappy and that means you both lose, and sometimes, a lot of the time, you end up both being happy in the relationship.
Well, that sounds thematic.
Yeah. Really hit the nail on the head in the whole relationship thing. And honestly, one of the things I actually love about Fog of Love, going back weirdly enough to John Company, is I feel like it is a simulation.
Yeah.
And it really captures that, and it's not simulating war or financial catastrophe, but it really does feel like you are running through a relationship, and it models it so well. You do things to make the other person happy, or you do things to make them upset because you want to be happy, and it just kind of fits that so well. But the real reason I wanted to talk about it is because they just announced this week that they have been working with Nikki Valens, who recently left Fantasy Flight Games, and I've been beyond excited to see what her next project was, and because she has made some games I truly love, Eldritch Horror, some games that I find absolutely fascinating, like Legacy of Dragonhold, and some games that I didn't quite fall in love with, but again, find fascinating, like Mansions of Madness, and she's just a tremendous designer with these story designs, and she is a non-binary individual, and she is... worked with Jacob, the designer, going through and making sure all of the cards are as inclusive as possible. Because she said she loved the game, but when she played it, she didn't feel necessarily like she belonged in that world, which is something that you hear a lot from non-binary individuals. And the big story that she ended up reworking the most is the pregnancy story. There was no options for adoption or other paths that certain individuals have to take in order to have children, and that made her feel just basically unwelcome, and the designer, after hearing about this, went to her, worked with her, cleaned up the whole game. There's a second edition with three different covers now, representing a heterosexual relationship and homosexual relationships as well. So just a big push for inclusivity here. And in addition, at Shucks and Essen, she'll be showing off a prototype for a complete LGBTQIA expansion that she is working on as well, which has me beyond excited to delve into as soon as it comes out, because I while there was inclusion there in the game, I feel like I'm also going to be brought more into the world as well with this push. So yeah,
and I mean, I think it's great. I think anything that can get more people to the table, whether it's this game or any game, is what we want to do in the hobby. What the Portal wants to do as a store, you know, being a podcast about that, and just what I want to do at my table. I mean, 111 people came through my door, or whatever, it's turnstile attendance, but you get my point, you know, this weekend, and getting more people at the table. So I think this is great, what they're doing there. What I love about Fog of Love is, actually, I love how it gives you characters. I think that's so key, that you're not playing yourself, necessarily, and so it can take you out of that element to be able to do something so that you could play, you know, with this new piece and have characters or whatever it is. When I've played with Kathy, you know, if I decide my character is going to try to end the relationship or become dominant in the relationship, whatever it is, that's I'm playing the role of my character. And it's still, you still get that feeling of, I'm sorry, I'm going to break your heart, but I know that that's not Brant breaking Kathy's heart. You know what I mean? I really like that piece, so I think they've done a great job with the game. And yeah, it's definitely a simulation. You're definitely playing it to see what the ups and downs of the relationship are and where it works out in the end. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. The one thing I did want to add, though, is I do find it funny, as someone who is just completely unable to put myself into a character, I'm just really not good at that kind of pretending. I really love this game because I also can just play as like a mixed version of myself and a character, okay. And it still succeeds so well for me because the simulation aspects are so strong too. I just, like whenever I take an action as me, the game just responds and gives me feedback like, this is what happens. And it's just so cool to, like, as I said, for John Company, just strap in and ride the game, like, just ride. And it works for me in that sense, and I've heard so many people who have talked about the game, like Brandt has, saying that they love being able to just play a character, because then it doesn't become as intensely personal either.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's just a tremendous design, and one you should really check out. And in the weirdest of places, the Walmart web store, which just honestly feels like a punchline to like a BoJack Horseman episode. this great game, and where do you get it? No, Walmart. No, not Walmart. The web store at Walmart.
Yeah. I know it was huge for them. I remember them announcing, because I was a backer on Kickstarter, and I backed very few games on Kickstarter, and I backed this game. I was all excited for it. And it was exciting for them when they were part of Walmart, which is still great for them with distribution. But yeah, now it just feels like, for a game that's becoming so popular, you know, it's kind of hidden at this point, where it could be on shelves where people could find it and see it, especially with those new covers.
But they are sold out, though. Like, yeah. That's why they're doing that. That's part of why they're doing this second edition and making sense. And he said whenever he was doing this second edition, he looked at the game and wanted to clean up all those concerns. So and because they're doing successful, we also get to see that. So that's nice. But yeah, I highly encourage anyone who's considering. Considering getting it to get it, because it is really that good.
Nice. Well, that's what's been on our table. Let us know what's on your table. You can email us at portalgamingpodcasts@gmail.com. All right, we come to our discussion topic for episode 105, which I don't think I actually gave the title of. Always doing Star Wars titles here, so this one's going to be I Suggest a New Strategy, R2. Mason's going to tell us about the topic that he wanted to talk about this episode. So go ahead.
Hello. So, this is a topic that I've always wanted to explore, because I am someone who, as I mentioned in my intro, can be really competitive, and I know whenever I started getting into board gaming, I would sit down at the table, and often with a bunch of sharks, and just get shredded. So I kind of wanted to always see a generic primer to strategy games. Now, there are so many games, and they play so differently, that's kind of a daunting task, but I just want to give like some quick hits on the various things that when you sit down at a table, you see a new game, how do you go about at least making a good push at winning it? And I am someone who, for better or worse, has been sometimes known around the Chits and Giggles group and at the Portal to be a little bit of a shark whenever it comes to games. So I do feel like for some games I can talk about this at least somewhat intelligently, although you can let me know how I did. And so that's kind of where I wanted to start. Do you have any thoughts of when you sit down to a table, what you normally start thinking about?
So it's funny. I'm very non-competitive. Now, I will try to win, and I absolutely will, and I will put my full brain power, and I'm good at winning games, so I'm not worried there, but I'm on the opposite end of that spectrum. Often, if I'm teaching, my biggest concern is, did I get the rules right? Is everybody enjoying it? I can't make people enjoy it, but are they not enjoying it because they don't understand something, right? Or whatever it is making sure it's a game that's of somebody's style, usually is what I'm hoping, you know, that I pick something for people. So I'm usually worrying more about those in terms of that. But I love what you have here, because I definitely bring those in. I'm like, well, if this is this style game, I'm going to fall back on these three that I know that I do well at, and try to do exactly what's in those. So I think this is great for people to have just a starting point. And then then you get to a game where it doesn't fall into the standard category, right? And doesn't do the same thing. And then you have to kind of adjust your strategy from there. So,
yeah. Neat. Yep, absolutely. And yeah, and for what it's worth, I think the thing about board gaming is most people, including myself, do try to make sure everyone's having a good time first and foremost.
I consider
that to be the most important thing. I just wanted to, because there are people who do kind of go home at the end of the night and they think, how many did I win? Because, you know, it is part of why you're playing the game. It's in the roles you're trying to shoot for the win. So, yeah, and like you said, you do always shoot for the win.
Yeah,
so.
I would never look at it as competitiveness as a bad thing. Competitiveness isn't a bad thing. The fringe effects of that could be a bad thing, right? If winning is the only thing, and so you make everybody not have fun because you didn't win, that would be a bad thing. But wanting to win is not a bad thing.
Yeah. So
it'd be foolish to play and not want to win.
Yeah. So the first thing that I put down, and I feel like a lot of people are going to be looking at me and being like, well, duh, but whenever I started this, I wrote down at the very top of the sheet, victory points, because one of my big wake-up moments, especially moving from Magic into hobby games, is the idea that you just have points that is just your running score of what you're trying to get. And for me, like, I was always, like, focused on developing an engine, developing a board state, developing, like, the groundwork. But I never really had this concept that these points are sometimes the thing that I need to be focusing on above all.
Sure.
So I think that the first thing I would do when sitting down for a game is noticing, like, what gives you the big points, when those points are available, when try and figure out. You don't have to get this exactly right, because honestly, most people at the table won't ever be getting it exactly right. But what is the turn of the game that I want to be looking at switching from building my engine to getting victory points? And I think a lot of people don't always even realize that turn exists.
Yeah.
What do you think on that? And
no, I mean, that's definitely a classic thing. So if I'm given the choice in round one of, do you want to take these two resources or do I want to take these two victory points? It's two resources. But if I'm given that same thing in round X, you know, then I have to decide which should I do, you know, in terms of how late into the game is X, right? That's kind of what you're looking at. Also, I feel like piggybacking with that is, you know, let's say you draw a card, some kind of contract or something that can score you big points. Like, it seems like a lot, but it's obviously very hard to do. It's knowing, when should I go for that and when should I let that slide, right? That's kind of another piece of this victory point puzzle. Like, if it's late in the game, I may not have enough time to pull that off. If it's early in the game, do I want to focus all my resources and all my energy on trying to score that big card, or would I rather just score a whole bunch of little ones? I think both of those kind of ride together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do like that you hit upon that, because I also think that those strategies, I've seen games in which those strategies change a considerable amount, like Lords of Waterdeep is a big one because of those character cards you get.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to be doing that, if you're going to be doing that small strategy, you need to absolutely make sure that every one of those small cards matches your character.
Right.
But if you're doing the big one, I found that, like, the big point payoff, you getting such a huge chunk of points all at once, it doesn't really entirely matter that it matches, because those 4-point hits you get for each quest, you're only getting, like, 3 or 4 of them.
True, yeah.
So watching, yeah, and but even with this, it always goes back to victory points and just making sure that you contextualize the best way to get the most of them.
Yeah.
And just always keep that in the back of your mind, even if the engine building is the most fun, the one that releases those endorphins in your brain because you just got the next piece, the next cog in your gear works. Just make sure that it is leading to victory points.
Yeah. I think knowing the length of the game is going to be really key to that strategy. So basically try to figure out the length of the game and figure out where halfway is and kind of divide there. The front half is generating engine and resource, the back half is generating points, is the simplest way to go about that. I think about those big scorecards. I've been playing Jump Drive a lot, the like little mini Race for the Galaxy, and I feel like you have to get a big number card on the table in that game to win. Like, they really score a lot. So, like, a development that's 7, 8, or 9, or a planet that's 5, 6, or 7, like, you need to get one of those out. And it seems like the player that does that, if both players do it, then it could be a wash. But if nobody, or if one player doesn't get those out, that can be a big difference. So
yeah, and actually, I would, if people are looking to improve at this skill, I would actually highly recommend Jump Drive as a game, because you, everyone at the table is going to want to play it a second and third time,
right,
and you get to watch that in action. If you're trying to play something like Lisboa, you're not going to be able to iterate your strategies ever, basically, because I think most people are going to play Lisboa two times lifetime.
Or anybody else's, because you're not going to know what anybody else did.
Yeah.
But Jump Drive, you might be able to pay attention to what other people do, because it's so short.
Yeah, and then just try a different thing. Maybe copy what they did last game, and you'll get to really learn a system and learn that skill better than you would have by playing heavier, longer games. And then you can even take something like Jump Drive and use those skills in other games.
Cool.
So yeah, the one other thing about victory points I wanted to mention is you definitely mentioned the decision point about do I take two resources or two victory points. The one type of game where that's different, and anytime I see this, I know the designer knows their system, is whenever they give you a lot more victory points in the early games, because you need to be like, okay, the designer knows this; they're probably balanced this, so maybe this is a decision.
Yeah.
Castles of Burgundy was my biggest wake-up call on this.
Yes. And completing plots or whatever they are, right?
Yeah, so. Yeah, you get like 12 points in the first round for completing plots, but like 2 in the last round.
Yeah.
And that, what that means, though, is that you want to complete a bunch of really small plots in that first round.
Mm-hmm.
And that will give you the big payoff. Then you can work on the bigger ones in the later rounds, which don't really diminish in points as much, because big plots do score more points in small plots.
Yeah, that's a great point. That definitely leads to the tightness of that game.
Yeah.
Cool, so that's victory points. What's your next one we got?
I actually still had a few more on victory points. Sorry.
Awesome. No.
So one more, if you don't know these games, it's no big deal, but they're both from the same designer, so I kind of wanted to compare and contrast one element of them, and that's Mombasa versus Great Western Trail.
Perfect, I know them both.
But I was talking more about the audience.
Oh.
I actually was like almost positive in them both.
Well, audience, I'm doing great. How are you?
Mombasa gives you points at the end of the game for coins. So does Great Western Trail, but Mombasa doesn't gives you a victory point for every single coin you earned at the end of the game. So as soon as you see that when you're being taught the game, realize that you can just start hoarding coins, and they're kind of like just good to have in general. But in Great Western Trail, whenever they're saying, yeah, you get a victory point for every 5, don't end up with coins at the end of a game like that.
Right.
You don't want coins at the end of a game like that. That just means you are being inefficient.
Yeah. Martin Wallace is really nice about that, because almost all Martin Wallace games, money is nothing but the tiebreaker.
Yeah.
He doesn't give you anything. So it's like, have no money at the end of Age of Steam. Have no money at the end of Brass.
Yeah, it doesn't even trick you.
They're not worth anything to you. In fact, if you have it, you probably did worse, because you didn't turn that money into points.
Yeah. But also with something like Mombasa, watch out for those trade-offs, because that means that... because that means that every time you're spending coins on something, that is losing you a whole victory point each time.
Mm-hmm.
And I have certainly watched games, usually in my opinion, poorly designed games, but I still like to win those, where near the end of the game, you will start trading off these things that are worth points to do other things, and you just end up start making moves where you're actually net losing victory points. And I have watched people literally take actions in games that cause them to just lose victory points.
Right.
And be better off if they didn't act, because they're like, oh yeah, of course I want to complete a contract, why wouldn't I?
Yeah.
It is always a good idea, and this is kind of a pain in the butt and like starts to turn a game into work a little bit, but you do want to watch out out for making sure you're never doing that and never getting tricked into doing that. That's where just your math is going to have to come in.
Yeah, it's almost like you have to know you especially in Euro games, you need to know what's a resource worth, what's a buck worth or a coin worth, what's a point worth, and what's an action worth. Like, almost all of those, you need to figure out, is there a trading, you know, amount of currency between all of those? So that you can figure out, is it worth this action to do this thing? Right? Is it going to take me 3 actions to score 2 points? Is that worth it? If it's going to take me 3 coins to score 2 points, is that worth it? That kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think, I actually think Castles of Burgundy is one that kind of does this, where you can get tiles that let you do an action where you'll get like 4 workers instead of 2.
Oh, yeah.
And then I think there's might be another tile that makes workers score more. I haven't played that game in so long. But I think like once you get a confluence of those tiles, it becomes so rare that you can take an action that's better than just taking workers right. And getting the points for it.
Yeah.
And you're almost just kind of beg off from playing the whole game.
Yeah.
But that is something that kind of works its way into the equation. Now that you have that engine set up, you need to look at yourself and be like, every action I take had better get me 3 victory points, because if it's not, I should just take workers.
Right, yeah. It's like the waitress strategy in Food Chain Magnate. If I just play waitresses all the time and I don't beat that, if I don't beat the person who just keeps playing waitresses.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly.
Everything I did was irrelevant because it wasn't even as good as that basic strategy where that person could just be a bot at that point.
Yeah, that's a good thing to always set for yourself, is set baselines and watch and make sure you're kind of hitting them.
Cool.
Next one I kind of want to talk about, and this is watch out for what I would call unintuitive strategies, and just make sure that you're doing the checks to see if they're good. What I mean by that is, for example, Rising Sun, which I talked about at the top, is a game in which it's a war game. I want to control areas, right? Well, there are plenty of battles in Rising Sun where near the whenever we get to the war phase, that we have our battles, and I put my bids on like Seppuku and Imperial Poets, and I'm not going to win that battle. But like we look at the end of the battle, and I just put 1 coin there, 1 coin there. I lose the battle. All of my guys are dead, and I scored like 12 points, and I sometimes will jokingly look at the other person and just be like, do you feel like you won the battle?
Yeah, yeah.
or I've had people look at me and be like, they hand me my chip, like, because you get a little placard when you win a battle, they hand it to me and they're like, do you feel like a winner? Because here's your winner's trophy.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm like, I don't want this. So always watch out for those. If there's ever a chance that doing the unintuitive thing is good, just make sure you have your finger on the pulse. Do you, off the top of your head, anything you can think of that's...
Yeah, I think it's the Loki strategy in Blood Rage.
Yep.
So it's the, oh, I'm going to take all these cards that tell me to die, and then I'm going to go start a whole bunch of battles and lose them,
yep.
And that's how I'm going to get there. Part of this, I don't know if this is exactly where you're going, but... Whenever I'm playing a game with Brian, it's always Brant's out to a big lead, and Brian's way behind. And I'm completely under the assumption every time that he's weaving some mass point-scoring engine, and at the end of the game, when we reveal endgame points, he's going to have thousands of points to my 85-point lead that I had on him. And only now, having played for like 10 years or 7 years, whatever we've been playing together, I'm like, no, he's just always trying to do that. But he only pulls it off like 25% of the time. But that's his favorite. He did play Terraforming Mars at VonnerCon, where he won the game, but he only terraformed twice. So he only got to 22 terraforming rating, but he managed to score all the other points and go around everybody.
That's awesome.
And he said even in the last round or the last 2 rounds, he took the terraforming points, and he didn't want to, just to be like, I didn't terraform anything, but I won the game. Anyway, you know, in that time it worked for him, but often it doesn't.
Yeah.
But that's kind of in that unintuitive. Like, you're not trying to do what the game seems to be telling us to do. Like, inherently it's giving us points for doing all these things, and you're not doing that, but you've got a bunch of face down cards and pockets of resources all over. What are you doing? You know, that one's a little different, but I do think that Blood Rage strategy is similar.
Yeah, and there's one more, I would call this famous at this point, and that's the Stone Age one. I bet you know what I'm talking about. Starving your people.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, where that is, I am known as, like, I literally don't play Stone Age any other way. I always end up in that strategy, and that is, in Stone Age, much like in Agricola, you have to feed your people every round. You have to go get food and feed them. Now, the thing is, if you ever get into a spot where you end up gaining more people, and you don't actually work on your food infrastructure, it just becomes correct to take the 10-point hit every time, that's where the difference lies. It's a small little thing. In Agricola, every single food you're short, you lose 3 victory points.
Right.
That's devastating and almost impossible to come back from. Sure. In Stone Age, every time you're short on food, you just lose 10 points. Mm-hmm. If you're 1 short, 10 points. Right. If you're 100 short, 10 points.
Yeah.
And that, so what you do is you're like, oh, let's see what happens if I'm just short on every single person every single round. And, well, there you go. You end up... that ends up being something that is perfectly viable. And honestly, for Stone Age, I am almost positive that if you talk to the people who are really good at the game and going to, like, WBC to play it, there should always be someone at the table doing that strategy.
Like, do you think that one's broken at that point?
Oh, no, it's not. No, it's certainly not broken. I have, it's just a good strategy.
Gotcha.
You can win in any different way in that game. I just know that, I know that strategy way better than the other strategies.
Sure.
So, I feel like I'm pretty good at it by now. But, if you, Magic drafts actually get to that point where, if you're playing a draft, that you like, and there are some people at the table, you're like, oh, I know what he's doing.
Yeah.
So if he starts passing me cards or whatnot, I'm like, okay, I can't go into this strategy because he's just going to be taking all the cards for it.
Yeah.
And Stone Age is a very similar way. If you're ever sitting next to me, you might have a hard time going into the starvation strategy because I might, what I would call, force it.
Yeah.
Like, even if it's not necessarily the best thing right then, I might still do it anyway, kind of pushing other people out. But yeah, that's...
Cool. Makes sense.
So, since we've been talking about Stone Age, a different point I wanted to bring up is Stone Age versus Lords of Waterdeep. Stone Age, and this is just like kind of a case study, I would say.
Sure.
Stone Age is a game that I would say is, there are just spaces that are better than others. Right, like,
sure.
I would say wood is usually, in my opinion, other than the 3 village spaces and grabbing, like, a clutch card at the bottom, the very next thing I want to do is just grab wood.
Yeah.
Put all of my guys there, and the reason for that is because whenever you're buying cards, they take any different kind of resource, so wood is just easier to get than anything else, making it better than other stuff.
Yep.
Because there's such, like, a tight pick order in this game, it becomes a game about, like, picking your battles, picking your moments on when you can sneak in something that's better than something else, and you're just always evaluating, like, what is the best space that's might make it around to me or whatnot. But Lords of Waterdeep is... Like, they're always compared all the time, but they're such wildly different games from a strategic standpoint because Lords of Waterdeep is all about building your engine. So now what you do is you look around the table and you're like, he needs orange cubes, so I know he's just going to take that spot.
Yeah.
And so what you can end up doing more so in that game than in Stone Age is like, okay, since he's taking the orange cube spot anyway, I can grab this. Or more importantly, if I really need orange cubes too, I better grab it because it's not making it around to me. Even if the orange cube spot's not a good spot,
right?
It's still like, oh, I have to go for it because, well...
That makes sense.
I think just kind of, I don't know, contextualizing, what type of game, it is, even, and, like, noticing the subtle differences.
So how would somebody who is sitting down to play Stone Age or Lords of Waterdeep for the first time from those two case studies, what would you, how would they figure out what's happening there? Just kind of paying attention to what resources are available and whether individual players are getting individual goals or whether there's group goals. Is that kind of what you would think of? Like, because everybody can get the tiles at the bottom in Stone Age, but I draft the quests and now I'm going on those quests in Lords of Waterdeep, right?
Yes.
So it's kind of paying attention to what's available to what players?
Yeah, and realizing when someone grabs a quest, realizing what they want and the fact that, like, what they want, what that means for me. So, like, if you wanted, like, wizards, purple cubes, it's not making it around to me.
Yeah.
Watching out for that. But in Stone Age, like, everyone wants wood.
Right.
Just know that that is a spot that may not make it back to you because it's just good to go there. Thank and you. Knowing what the strong spots are. Now, there is a light flavoring of that of the Lords of Waterdeep thing I mentioned in Stone Age, where if I'm doing the starvation strategy, which I mentioned earlier, I'm not really going to be taking those cards that bump up my food production, because I lagged so far behind in food production anyway, that just is literally a worthless resource to me at this point. That's kind of the big thing, is just recognize, like, you're just looking for the good stuff in Stone Age, but in Lords of Waterdeep, you're kind of paying attention, you need to pay attention a little more to what someone might be doing.
Cool. I think we got time for one more. Do you have one more of these that we could discuss? And maybe we'll have you on again in a future episode to talk more of these.
Oh, sure. If people like this. Otherwise, I can talk about something else. But
pick up one more that we could talk about
here. Yeah, I wouldn't mind just doing some quick hits on worker placement. Just know that anytime you're sitting down for a worker placement game, the big thing is just look for things that give you more workers. Because that's your action economy. That is, once you go from 2 to 3 workers, you're literally doing 100. You're doing 50% more than you would have. You get two more. Like, you have 2 workers, and then you get 2 more workers. You're doubling your output.
Yeah. The other one I would mention too is if you're last to pick every round, it's pretty much the game's begging you to pick the first player token.
Yep. Terrific. Those are the two biggest quick hits on worker placement, I would say. So and that's just such a big genre, I wanted to bring it up.
Yeah.
Deck building. What do you do in deck building?
You get rid of your cards.
Great. I remember first time I ever played Dominion, I was talking to my friends. I'm like, this chapel card is such garbage. I just want to draw more cards. And they like look at me and they're like, that's literally the best card in the game.
Right.
Like borderline, pretty much a mistake that Donald Vaccarino put it in the game. And they're like, what? And I'm like, what do you mean? All right, play your next game, play the card, trash everything in your hand.
Yeah.
And just tell me how the game goes.
Yeah.
I do that and I come back to them and I'm like, oh my. Like, that was the most fun I've ever had playing that game. Because it's just, and that's because the cards that you get are so much better than the cards you start with in most deck builders that you being able to not see them again is just amazing, because you're going to now only be seeing your new cards, which are often literal orders of magnitude stronger than what you had started with.
Have you played Valley of the Kings or Heart of Crown?
I have played Valley of the Kings.
Okay. Both of those have what I love, which is you have to get the cards out of your deck to score them.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that mechanism, because now doing the thing that you love in deck builders, thinning your deck to make it more efficient, is the scoring mechanism as well. So it's kind of leading everybody to that. I love that element.
Oh yeah, it is really interesting in that game though, because you have these power, because also the powerful cards, if you trash them, also score more.
Yeah.
So you have this weird thing where you're like, okay, I want to get it out of my deck, but not until the end of the game.
Yeah.
So when's the game ending?
Yeah. And that's kind of goes back to our victory point discussion.
Yeah, right? That is a weirdo of a game as far as I'm concerned. And last quick, I don't know if we have time for one or two more quick hits, but area control. The one small thing that I think, and since Brant mentioned El Grande, I'll mention it again. Watch when you're allowed to take second place in an area, because everyone is always focusing on having the most in one spot for like an area, for like a game like that. I've won a lot of games of El Grande by having a cube in every spot.
Yeah.
And I'm just like screaming up the board because I'm like, okay, I get 2 points here, 2 points here, 2 points here, 2 points here. And then someone who poured all of their cubes in one spot is like, okay, I get 5 points. Right. It's like, well,
does second place work in Rising Sun at all?
No.
Yeah, okay.
So yeah, well, it only works.
No, I'm just giving. I'm just trying to think off the top of my head. Is that?
Yeah.
I'm not trying to attack your strategy.
Yep. But yeah, that is that's the biggest thing with area control games. I found the other thing with area control games I found is make sure that you get you only win by one or two because no one cares if you have 20 guys in a spot. That's just a waste of probably 18 guys if the next person only had one in there.
Right.
Okay. So don't waste all of your energy taking over a spot harder. I would go into trick-taking just a little bit, but that is so far afield of traditional games that we could either save it for next time or maybe have an episode on it, because I could talk about trick-taking games forever.
That'd be great, because I forgot that that's your bread and butter, and then you mentioned it at the start of the episode, and I was like, that's right, that's a good one. Awesome, well, thank you so much, Mason. That was fun. That was good. Talking about all those games at the top, those were good hits from this year and last year, I believe, right? when did John Company come out? Is that a 2017 or 2018?
I think it's 2018.
Okay.
I think it's early though. Like Rising Sun, you probably think was last year, but no, it was this year, except for those like light little copies that went out for like the Jack Vassell Memorial Fund and things like that. But yeah.
Cool. Nice. All right. Well, that's it for episode 105. And until next time, I'm your host, The Brant.
And I'm Mason.
And we hope you step into the portal. Portal Game Podcast is a product of Time Machine Toy and Hobby Store / The Portal, which is located at 71 and 60 Hilliard Street in Manchester, Connecticut. This episode was recorded on October 13, 2018. Please send any questions to us at portalgamingpodcast@gmail.com. Portal Game Podcast is a proud member of the Dice Tower Network. For more awesome podcasts, visit www.dicetowernetwork.com. And hey, thanks for listening. We hope you win more games.